This is Comics Therapy, episode 18, No Reviews, Just Analysis. Up this week, three new comics from November 20th, 2013. Animal Man number 25, Avengers AI number 6, and Zero number 3. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we have illustrator and letterer Clayton Coles. Just as a reminder, we don't do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so this is your spoiler warning.
Hey, this is Matt from Two-Headed Nerd calling. I saw you had a villain question for your nerd confession this week, and so I just had to call and confess my favorite villain, hands down, Dr. Doom. I don't love to hate him, I love to love him. In fact, I usually root for Dr. Doom. He is far and away the most impressive, badass, egotistical, and interesting villain in the Marvel Universe as far as I'm concerned. I love his armor, I love his cape, I love his castle in Latveria. I love the guy, Dr. Doom. That is far and away my favorite Marvel villain. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme of the show this week is keep your enemies close. Whether they're fighting you tooth and nail out in the open, plotting against you in another dimension, or all in your head. It's important to stop and take stock of just what exactly you are up against.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions and nerd stories. We want to celebrate the little geeky things we all do, say, read, and enjoy. Share them with us, and we'll share them on an upcoming episode of the show. This week's prompt asked listeners to share their favorite comics villains, and it was pretty cool to get some great stories from everyone. You can call, Skype, or email your general confessions, too, at any time. All the details are on the website, comicstherapy.com, but we're digging these theme stories, so I think we're going to do more of those in the future, so keep an eye out for them. And remember, catharsis is cool.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers, and of course the show account, at Comics Therapy. I also wanted to take a second to address something. Is it true that you cut your pull list to 30 titles a week?
That's what I'm trying to do. After a lot of soul-searching, talking to my priests.
You're Jewish, dude.
No, I have priests.
Okay.
I have people.
You have people.
Yeah. Some of them are priests.
What are the people telling you?
They were, it was a lot of consulting, a lot of focus groups, and kind of came down to what makes an enjoyable new comic book day. And sometimes you just can't read all the comics.
Okay. I can hear the pain in your voice. You're really dealing with this admirably. But what sort of parameters do you use to decide which books you're going to keep and which ones you're going to cut?
That is hard and totally arbitrary, I guess.
I would not expect anything else from you.
But how does anyone, though? Like, you decide, am I enjoying this series? Am I enjoying it more than the other things on my list? And does it stay or does it go?
Right.
Until you're down to the number that you arbitrarily picked as the number you are going to try to stick to every month.
Right. And I've had this conversation with a couple of people recently who are, for whatever reason, making similar decisions. And nobody has any particular type of like transferable metric,
yeah,
which I think is interesting and obviously speaks to how subjective our interests all are.
Yeah, I mean, I think 30 is a pretty reasonable number. And I mean, I came, at least for that number, I kind of came to that as a conclusion of what I have time for during the week, up until Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
That includes what do we get that I'm reading, like, I don't read 30 issues on a Wednesday. There's just no way. Mm-hmm. I read like 15, maybe 20 if I really have time. But okay. Realistically, it's maybe like 15-ish or so. So the rest, though, I've already have read because we have access to media copies of most independent publishers. So I read throughout the week. And then on Wednesday, it's usually like Marvel and DC stuff.
So I also suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not ultimately going to end up missing much, right? Because things that you may not be buying on an ongoing basis, you're going to pick up in trade eventually, right?
Well, are we putting all the cards on the table?
I don't know. I don't know, Aaron. Are we?
Well, I mean, I want to be realistic. There's not a ton of stuff I'll pick up and trade anymore. Just because...
Really?
I just won't... I won't go back and read it. I won't have time. There's graphic novels, and there's independently published, non, like, scheduled stuff that I read throughout the week, too. If I'm dropping a book that's a weekly title, it's probably not something I'm going to... Or, you know, or a monthly title. It's probably not something I'm going to pick up again.
Wow. So this is fucking finite. This is, like, the end of an era.
No, but the things change, but... Especially maybe like a limited series or an independent series. If it doesn't make the cut, I'm probably not going to go back and read what I'm missing in collected.
This is devastating. I don't know if I can record the rest of the show. I feel like I'm all choked up.
This is hard for all of us. But I also have found it, like, even this week, found it really hard to get 30 books at the comic book store. Digital, too. Like, there were 3 Monkey Brain books that came out today that weren't on my list of 30. So I guess technically this week is ending up at 33.
Mm-hmm. You've already broken your rules.
Already broken my rules, but those are outliers. They weren't accounted for.
But Monkey Brain is typically an outlier for you because it's not on your list.
It's not on my list because I can't buy printed copies of it until it comes out in print. Just like Bandette or something. Like, the Bandette hardcover came today. You know, and I've already read it all, but I wanted a physical copy of it.
Sure, but then that doesn't count against your 30.
No, because it also doesn't fall into my time constraints. It's not like a monetary issue or anything. It's really just, what do I have time for?
Right.
And it's really, okay, by the time I get home from the comic book store and can read during the day, I could read a total maybe of 40 to 45 books a week. I have been, but I'm rushing. You know, I'm not enjoying them the way I should.
So I think that this is an interesting, like, struggle for you. I'm interested to hear how you kind of resolve it over the next couple of weeks, because I think you're going to make adjustments.
Well, I was already looking at next week, and my initial list is 44 comics. And that doesn't include digital or anything like that. Like, I don't know how I can cut 14 from that.
Right. So I think this is good. This is good for you. And I think the fact that you picked 30 as an arbitrary benchmark for what you can accomplish in a week is going to bite you in the ass. And I, for one, will be the first one to laugh.
I guess. I don't know why that's funny at all.
It's funny because it's not realistic.
No, but, I mean, there's time. Time is an actual factor. And, I mean,
Absolutely. Ultimately
what this comes down to is I kept having to ask myself, am I getting to enjoy all the books I'm reading as much as I would like?
And I completely support all of that. But I think picking a number each week rather than looking at all of the titles holistically and making a choice based on content is what's going to ultimately do you in.
No, that's fair. I mean... I'm choosing 30 as a number that I would like to hit as, like, this is what I have time for. But, like, next week, it'll probably be, like, 35, 36.
Right, because there are more actual stories that you're interested in. And it's possible that some week you may have, like, 26. That's all. I'm just making fun of you because your approach is so you. It's so just... hysterically, like, linear and anal and has nothing to do with the actual books themselves. And I think it's hilarious.
It's the only way I can wrap my head around it, because I can't say, like, I'm gonna cut the books I'm not enjoying as much, because the criteria for that is really hard for me to, like, comprehend, like, what book is not good enough for me to want to continue to read more.
Do you want me to design a rubric for you?
Sure. I need some sort of flow chart.
Absolutely. You can evaluate all of the books, and then which ones pass the cut, those are the ones you continue to read.
Well, should we move past the scandal for now and talk just about our week?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Do we already about it? Is that really all that matters this week?
I think that's going to continue to be the highlight of my week. No, actually, that's not true. The highlight of my week was, like, nostalgic remembrance of role-playing games, all things.
I was very surprised to find out that you were this type of nerd.
Ah, Elaborate, please, because I would love to know what kind of nerd you think I am.
I just think of you in high school as like a goth girl.
Oh, absolutely not.
But
absolutely.
You wore like the sexy goth clothes because you thought it was kind of like alternatively cool, or you had like a Ramones t-shirt or something.
I was never, ever, ever a goth girl, ever.
Were you a skater girl?
I'm not sure I know what that means, but I guess that would be closer than goth.
Hmm. Like, were you a grunge girl?
That was, that was like junior high school, right?
Yeah, through like mid high school.
Yeah.
Yeah, flannels, ripped jeans.
I did, like cutoffs and thermals and combat boots.
Oh, sure. Okay, there you go.
Right?
Yeah.
Part of the cool look.
Sure.
But honestly, what does that have to do with role-playing games?
I don't know. They're not mutually exclusive or anything like that, but, I don't know what the words I'm looking for, but, you know, they're not related to each other, but they're not related
right.
to each other.
Okay.
I just don't picture you sitting around the gaming table slinging dice.
Well, that part is true. That's not ever been the, appeal for me. And really, it was only one game. It was only ever Shadowrun. And it was entirely because the premise is so fucking captivating. It's magic, and it's tech, and it's science, and it's politics, and it makes me giddy just thinking about it.
Yeah, but did you ever look at, like, GURPS? Like, GURPS was a lot like that, too.
So, I'm sure that there are a number of other games that kind of fit in that same, like, cyberpunk world.
Yeah.
It's just that this is the one that a couple of friends and I stumbled on, and it was... I know that we've laughed about the fact that, like, my head exploded, like, literally when... this came up the other day, but I haven't found anybody else who's played it.
Hmm.
I have like some almost cringe-worthy moments in undergrad of standing around drunk and talking about being a geek and crickets if I brought up that particular game.
Hmm.
I mean, no, just it wasn't on anybody's radar. So
you're hanging out with the wrong crowd.
Clearly. I mean, they were all theater people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Figures.
But but I've actually kind of had a lot of fun over the past, 48 hours of thinking about this game and, like, the impact it had on the types of literature that I read and the types of comics that I got into and the other types of media that I enjoyed. And it has a very important place in my, I guess... like, preferred content of choice. I love this kind of science fiction. I love the combination of genres in the way that Shadowrun combined them.
Mm-hmm.
And I love character-oriented storytelling. And so sitting around slinging dice is not what I think about when I think of role-playing games. I think about the character design, and I think about the storytelling, and, like, I fucking love that shit. So, yeah, that bring it on, dude. That's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I miss role-playing. I wish I had time for it. And I haven't played really since high school. We played all the time in high school, shockingly. I'm sure you're floored by that.
You are that kind of nerd.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was my group of friends. We would
right.
get together on a Friday night and play through the whole night till Saturday.
And that's awesome. And you also worked at Radio Shack. And that just fits, like, my adorable little sense of Aaron in high school.
The small town I lived in, Radio Shack was the coolest job you could get, for sure. And it paid pretty well. For, like,
uh-huh.
a little mountain town, Radio Shack was awesome.
Uh-huh. And I worked at a used bookstore, which is absolutely appropriate, given all of the other stereotypical teenage Andrea things.
Yes.
Yep. Got it.
Yeah.
It's fine. We both grew up to be, like, relatively normal people. We can carry on conversations in social situations, and it's fine.
Yeah, I can barely, but yes.
Do you want to talk about comic books?
I guess. Let's do it. Whatever.
What are you going to tell me about for 90 seconds? Do you have a plan?
Yes.
Okay. As soon as you are ready, sir, you may begin.
Go. So this week I'm going to talk about clothing. And how the availability...
No.
What?
No. I'm stopping the timer.
No way.
Aaron, Let me read for you what this segment consists of.
You didn't read it. I get to talk about whatever I want.
I figured that at this point, everyone was on the same page.
It's called...
I give Aaron 90 seconds to talk about whatever he wants that we don't have time to discuss more deeply. 90 seconds. One book. One new comic from the past week that we're not analyzing.
Uh-huh.
Get it?
Yeah.
Okay. You're penalized. Those seconds are not coming back on the clock. You may begin now.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about the availability of superhero outfits that are like...
Oh, for the love of God.
at stores these days. And it's really a renaissance for nerds. Like, I think some people could complain about how, like, comic books have been mainstreamed when you can buy, you know, Captain America shirts at Walmart, but... I kind of think it's awesome because you're not having to pay $30 for a shirt. You can pay $7 for a shirt. And now I have a closet full of pretty awesome shirts for, you know, not that much. So I embrace the mainstreaming of comics culture. And I don't care if it gets diluted, like perceptively diluted that way. Because really, the people that are into it are always going to be into it. And if mainstream people pretend to be into it, maybe someday they'll be into it too. So anyway, I wear my shirts from Walmart loud and proud, and I have no regrets on that.
Okay. I am going to, at this point, choose not to make a comment about exploitation of workers or anything of that nature. Because I think that your point is valid. I think Sorry, that was the buzzer, by the way. Your point is valid in terms of, like, spreading the joy. Your actual method of, you know, acquisition, I don't personally subscribe to, but to each his own. And I certainly enjoy you sharing your new shirts on a almost daily basis at this point.
Yeah, I actually decided I need to stop because I have a closet full at this point.
Was going to say that next.
No, I'm like... done. But well, at least for now, we're all slow down. Like, I have like 100 shirts at this point. So I think I'm good for a while.
Jeez, oh man.
Yeah, well, guys got to look good.
Okay, right. That was a giant fucking fail on your part. If you're not going to follow my rules, you're not going to play my game, and you won't be allowed to have your 90 seconds every week.
Okay, can I have 180 seconds?
Let's talk about comics.
All right, let's do it.
Greetings, comic therapists. This is Roderick Ruth at Roderick Ruth on the Twitter sphere, and my nerd confession this week is that my favorite villain is Negan from the Walking Dead comic book series. Negan is a dastardly repulsive character and has significantly influenced the world of The Walking Dead already, but he has slowly developed an evil charm and an empathetic simplicity for me, kind of like a vulgar, loud, and dumber version of Wile E. Coyote. My consolation prizes go to Venom, not the Flash Thompson Venom version, but the tongue-wagging, brooding, hulking Eddie Brock version. Also, Toyo Harada has been pretty awesome in the Valiant universe lately, as he's almost on all those titles and just kicking ass in all of them. Thanks, guys.
Our first book this week is Animal Man number 25. Animal Man is written by Jeff Lemire. Art is by Raphael Albuquerque and colors by Dave Mick Craig. And lettering is by Jared K. Fletcher. It's published by DC Comics.
It is. I didn't do a recap for this one.
Well.
But this is after... Oh, God, I don't have it in front of me, so I'm going to sound like a complete idiot.
That's good.
But, yeah, it's fine. It's just going to, like, lend credence to the fact that nobody thinks I read anything by DC.
Mm-hmm.
But this is... I actually do read this book. I was 4 issues behind, but come on. That's not that bad.
Sure.
So, coming off of, like, the huge Rotworld saga, Buddy and his family dealing with the aftermath of his son's death and... kind of what exactly is going on with the Red and what's going on with his daughter and his wife as they are separate from Buddy. So there's a lot of like aftermath that the past couple issues have been dealing with, as well as some introduction of new threats to the Red and new threats to Buddy's family in particular. Was that a general enough kind of state of the union?
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff going on, but then...
There's a bunch of stuff going on.
Right. So why don't you tell me why you continue then to read Animal Man?
You know, the original introduction that I had, Rod sent me this back in May. He sent me the first trade, and it was the art more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I was totally unfamiliar with the character. As introductions to the DC universe go, pretty standalone and like pretty approachable.
Yeah.
I didn't ever feel like, you know, what the hell's going on with these other characters coming into the story. Even during Rotworld, where there were a lot of cameos, I was able to figure stuff out. But the art at the beginning was so gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And there's something about a character like Buddy who doesn't know what he's capable of in both a good way and a bad way, and is working out who he is as a person and like coming from a place of personal failure and like this sense of obligation to provide for his family and kind of man up and not really having the ability to do that. When we first meet him, like at the start, like the relaunch during New 52.
Yeah.
Like, I just thought that he was so flawed and so like broken. And so his journey and his confidence building was really interesting. And then once I started, I continued to read. I read the next trade shortly thereafter, or I guess over the summer. And I kind of got more interested in the story. So it was less about Buddy as a character, and it became more about like his interactions within the larger like mythos of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess in that regard, it was a pretty successful introduction for me into like a whole new story that I hadn't had a lot of. Well, it's not even that I didn't have interest in it. It was like completely not something that I would have ever picked up on my own.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I talk to a lot of people about different comics, and I have a list of people who I trust to make the right decisions for me as a reader because they know me and they know what I like. And in this particular case, it was absolutely the right choice, and I have continued to read it because I have a rubric of sorts.
The flowchart said to continue to read it.
It did. Nice. I'm very good at diagrams.
Yeah, I think this. I like Animal Man too, and this is in the aspect when he is in his own book, because it's family oriented.
Mm-hmm.
The mythos of like the Swamp Thing and Animal Man and the totems and the green and the red, mm-hmm. and the life force and death and mm-hmm. decay and everything else is really compelling. It's really been done well throughout the years. Mm-hmm. And it's a different kind of aspect of the superhero universe, you know, aside from like Justice League, etc., that we don't, you know, we don't really have overexposure, I guess I would say.
It is. Like, the kind of naturalist angle to superheroes is very interesting. And I don't read anything else that touches on that that I can think of. I don't always love the family-oriented stuff. I find Ellen to be incredibly tedious. And I was complaining about her today, actually, and Roderick pointed out that she's the foil to Buddy, and I appreciate that, and I don't disagree. It's just that she is so repetitive in her like naysaying and so skeptical that I just find it like there's no development there.
Can I ask you, because it's not a uncommon kind of trope for the wife to be that, you know? And do you think that's kind of a failing of writers to kind of keep going back to that well, to always have the wife kind of be the trip up, the foil for the main character?
I do sometimes, because I think that anytime you are not allowing somebody to break out of the role of the skeptic, then they're always going to be like stilted in that regard.
Yeah.
And they're always going to be, no, no, don't use your powers. No, no. Like, it's about, it's so like micro-oriented, and the story has become much bigger than about their family. And so family drama is great, and we have talked about a lot of other comics that use family relationships as another side to the character exploration. But in this case, it's just not, it's not particularly realistic, and I don't find it to be a very compelling argument for what gives what gives him strength.
Yeah, I think that's partly, though, you don't see this as much in independent books, where those family dynamics are usually a little more fleshed out. It's definitely a fallback for DC and Marvel, where...
It seems dated.
Yeah, but I think it's a marketing thing, where there always has to be strife. And it's also, like, why there's mandates at Marvel and DC where characters don't get married, because... If they get married, people stop reading. That's the thought, which is not true. It's just if they get married, the writers haven't been able to write compelling things for them. I think it's still part of the mentality of there has to be, if there is already an established family, like Animal Man, there has to be strife and drama. If the family's not in peril, then you don't have a compelling B story. Mm-hmm. But it definitely detracts from the reality and an interesting dynamic of those characters.
She never clicked with me from the very beginning because there's something just kind of tiresome about a wife who's super frustrated with her husband who, like, can't provide for them. And like, he hasn't found himself yet. And so she's just berating him. And I don't know.
I think that's a minor complaint for me for this story, because I think that what's really interesting from a family perspective are the children.
Sure.
Like, I love the way the story has, you know, grown, especially with the daughter and the son's story and that sort of thing. And obviously that would cause strife within a family. Like, I don't think that's unrealistic.
No, I agree that, like, after... he died, there's going to be some major fallout, and all of that feels very raw, and again is like part of what Buddy is dealing with as he's once again like questioning what, like, who he is and like what his role is. The fact that he goes to the Red and like goes in and like yells and screams and pitches a fit and then basically has his access cut off, it is such a like an appropriate response to like the anger that he has of being so powerless from not being able to stop his son from dying. That's all fine and well, and even Ellen's like pushing away is also fine. I guess ultimately I felt like it just wasn't handled as creatively as it could have been, or she wasn't saying anything differently than she's been saying all along, and so it was actually less cathartic, watching her transition. That's all. So I think that now that they're dealing with a new conflict, and now that they're trying to...
They're to doing kind of it build... together, which yeah, I think yeah. is... They're... I think that is interesting, and that's a really good writing, mode.
Yeah. We'll see. I mean, it's also... It's also a problematic to have, like, superhero and, like, mortal woman, but whatever. Yeah. It's worked for Superman, so I'm sure it's going to be fun.
All right, well, let's... you want to move on?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, all. My favorite supervillain is Dr. Doom. Why? Because at any time, when asked why he does whatever awful deed he is just committing, he can answer, "I am Doom!" And the heroes are like, "Oh, that's right, Brad. Comic wasteland."
Next up, Avengers AI number 6, written by Sam Humphries and drawn by Valero Sheeti, I think is how it's pronounced. So colors are by Frank Diamata and lettering is by Clayton Coles. I'm not familiar with him, but Avengers AI is published by Marvel Comics.
So this is number 6 in this series, and here's your recap. Demetrios, the villainous AI bent on world domination, has cultivated a deep hatred between man and machine alike. The amnesiac android Alexis has broken the encryption on some of her memories. She was one of the first 6, a group of extraordinarily powerful AI, and the first to inhabit the diamond, the digital homeworld of the AI. Meanwhile, Hank Pym, blaming himself for how do you say Victor's last name?
You're asking the guy who can't, like, pronounce, like, Brown?
Very, very true. So, Victor's apparent death, Hank has swung into a depression. He's also revealed to Monica Chang that he has diagnosed himself as bipolar. Victor, thought to have died in the explosion on the abandoned oil rig that played host to the Diamond's server, survived. Just before the explosion, he was transported and trapped in the Diamond.
Yeah, I love this series.
You and I are the only ones, my friend.
No, that's not true. People love this series. It's just, it's not a mainstream book, but it doesn't mean it, it's not enjoyed.
Okay.
I think this series, as it grows, it's like, I feel like parts of this are almost like Rick Remender's, like, early, like, X-Force, like, where it took, like, 20 issues before everyone then started scrambling to get it all.
Okay.
So, regardless, I love it. I don't care. I love this series.
I think it's great. I think it's a lot of fun. I was particularly interested over the past two issues with what's going on with Hank. And I was so pleased with the way that his crazy nature was addressed at the end of Age of Ultron.
Uh-huh.
And then we saw him in this series, and it was like all of that character work that appeared at the end that Mark Waid had written was gone. And now we're getting back into it again. And he's just got so many issues. It's just so much that I am really intrigued by. And so watching his collapse after Victor died was kind of lovely in a very sad way.
Yeah, it's, I think, from a Marvel Universe standpoint too, the robots and artificial intelligences of the Marvel Universe are almost some of the most like compelling characters, because they have almost more depth and capability of any of the other characters in the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Vision is one of my favorite of all the characters.
Absolutely.
And I
think it took a couple issues from this series to kind of get in the groove, especially with the interplay with the Vision and with Hank.
Yeah.
And this one especially, kind of calling Hank on his shit is a great back and forth between the two of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it shows the depth of intelligence and character that he has. Mm-hmm. And all of these characters, I mean, even like, it, you know why it lends itself to such great writing too, is for some reason robots and the, you know, these artificial intelligences that should be stilted and non-human have the most potential for like humor. Like, you know, from a writing standpoint, you can make them funny, and when they're funny, it's extra funny because you're thinking of them as artificial, you know, fake.
Right.
And when they have emotion, it hits that much more, because it's this facsimile of humanity. But at the same time, it calls into the question, what is real? What makes us human?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it the physical body, or is it our capability for, you know, and the way we interact with each other?
Yeah, I think I'm hoping that this is more of Hank's story, though. I do believe that is what's happening, and that we're teasing more out of like, what is it about his personality and personality flaws that pushes him to produce essentially life in this way, like kind of constructing it as a replacement for like what he isn't able to do himself, or like the wrongs that he's brought on the world, or like whatever. But there's something about him that continues to like push this stuff out, and he's dealing with the consequences of that compulsion, or the book is dealing with the consequences of that compulsion in these past couple of issues in a way that I haven't really seen with Hank Pym's character in a while.
Yeah, no, I agree. He's been sidelined for a while in the Marvel Universe and put into secondary roles that didn't really explore his character this well. In a group of, you know, people, quote unquote, that he can really connect to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Pym, as a person, connects and opens up the most when he is with his creations, with his children in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. And it's so sad, actually. Like, when Monica busts in on him and he's, like, he's just in, like, shutdown mode. And I think that awareness that he has of like his mental struggles and his coping mechanisms for dealing with them, and the like need he has to feel like useful and and productive and positive as an Avenger. It tells a lot in a very short amount of time, the really how deep his issues go, and like how much of a struggle it is for him to just like get through the day sometimes. And I think that there are not a lot of opportunities in big two stories to expose a character quite like that.
Yeah, it's true. And we're going now to the future in this next arc, which I just love. The possibilities are endless.
Yeah, it's good. I think that it is always going to be a secondary book for me in terms of like Avengers stories, because it doesn't necessarily exist within like the big, like epic story that the main titles are covering. But it's a nice break from that.
Well, and I like those books though, because then they're not bound to whatever is happening in main continuity. Like Humphreys can kind of do whatever he wants with this.
Right.
You know, within,
and as long as it continues to be character focused and kind of watching what happens with Victor also, because I love Victor.
Yeah.
Is something to keep me reading this one, and hopefully more people do.
I hope so too. Well, let's move on.
Hey, it's Rudy, at Rudy Trev on Twitter. I'm calling in to say who I think the greatest villain in all of comics is. I think it's Aaron Myers himself. He's always trying to get Andrea to face zombies, and just this morning he tried to convince me that I needed a $400 page of art. Thanks. Keep up the good work.
Finally, we have Zero number 3. Zero is written by Ailes Cott and drawn by Mateus Santoluco.
100% sure that you pronounced all of those wrong.
Okay. Colors are by Jordi Blairley.
You're the worst. Are you just making shit up now?
I was kidding about that. Jordi Blair. And lettering by Clayton Coles. Zero is published by Image Comics.
Okay. Edward Zero is a secret agent. He works for the agency, and this comic deals with the story of his life. We also have Mina Thorpe, Zero's friend, who also works for the agency. And this particular issue, we are in 2019 for most of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that I like that it's a future setting, because then it allows you to inject technology that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not so far outside of the realm of our current, you know, time frame that it feels mm-hmm. foreign to.
Mm-hmm.
But really, this is a character study of like secret agents and sleeper agents and all that has to deal with future tech, but real life people too.
Mm-hmm.
But this is
pretty wonderful.
Yeah, but this is one of the few books that talking about the execution and creation of it is very important.
Okay, hit me.
Okay, well, because every issue has a different artist on it.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing where I saw people talking, like, some people were groaning, like, oh, you know, it'd be so inconsistent, and I don't want to see, you know, a different artist on it, and et cetera. Like, I knew that gives an opportunity in a unique way to tell a story differently than most other comics are, like, intentionally.
I agree.
You know, where you pick your artist for the issue that best matches that issue.
Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, I think issue number 2 is the clearest example of that, since we had a chance to look at Edward and Mina as they were children, kind of being groomed by the agency. And so the stylistic approach had a much cartoonier. That's doing such a disservice. And like, as an artist, I'm embarrassed that's the best word I can come up with. But the drawing style in the second issue, and even the coloring as well, just had a like more kid-like feel to it. So I think I agree with you. It's an interesting opportunity. I also really like consistency though. So
yeah, I think, think of it as consistently picking the artist that's best to tell the story mm-hmm. at that stage.
Right. And if it's a thing that they don't deviate from, then I'm all for it.
Yeah. But from a story standpoint, the character is really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't think we're going to talk a ton about this today because we're only in issue 3. But it's also something people should be aware of and be checking out, because there's a depth of story here. I think Cott is I think he's a really interesting up-and-coming writer.
Mm-hmm.
He's a really interesting
absolutely.
Guy.
Absolutely. I think, I don't, I know we warned for spoilers, but holy shit. The end of this issue was really upsetting. And because there's this connection between Edward and Mina. And like, you know me, I enjoy that like characters finding like-minded characters and the alignment in terms of relationships. Like, we're on the same team, not necessarily romantically, but like, you are an ally for me and it's us against the world and so on and so forth. And especially because they're working for this shadowy agency, capital A agency, it's comforting to see how they have each other's backs. And so, like, the end and then the subsequent, like, transcript as Edward is recounting what happened was, like, really emotionally powerful.
It's, I think, also that sort of death that when someone isn't even killed, they're just snuffed out of existence.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm willing to say that there was a death there. I don't know. Maybe.
I think it's safe to say.
There's like a layer of science fiction fuck-upness to this story that is only just beginning to be tapped into. So I think that it's way premature to say that something like that is like the end-all be-all death of a character.
Maybe. Well, I mean, we'll see, but regardless, okay, well, in general, a death like that, where someone, like, two characters are anchors for each other, and you don't even have a closure where it's like, oh, she was she's gunned down before my very eyes. It's just, you're gone. You know, wiped from the existence, as opposed to, you know, destroyed or something.
It's so sad.
Yeah. That's extra heartbreaking, because it unmoors you in a way that's totally foreign.
Yeah, it's great though. It gives some insight into Edward's future motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who exactly is the enemy in his mind? And I think he's, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if there is more and more evidence of not following orders quite like he was supposed to. And, you know, it's just some stuff that we saw in the first issue too. Like, he's not a brainless agent. He's really, really good at his job, and therefore the fact that he has like a spark of free will and connection to another human being is possibly the most dangerous thing about him.
Yeah, it's true. And now when someone has nothing left to lose, you know, that's when they're the most dangerous.
Like Punisher style.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, you want to talk about someone who has nothing left to lose? You want to talk to...
That was an interesting segue. I have to point out, because Clayton neglected to mention this, and I gave him, you know, just a little tiny bit of shit on the internet for it, that one of his favorite books, and I will put this on the site in addition to all the great music links that he mentions, one of his favorite comics, current comics, is Quantum and Woody. And so just a shout out right now, removed from the interview itself, that if that's not a book that you guys are reading, you should probably check it out, because we all love it, and it's one of Clayton's favorites, so I told him I would mention it before we got into the interview.
I wrote this specifically to make Aaron uncomfortable. I really hope he makes it to the end. Ra's al Ghul, pronounced either Raish or Race, not Ra's, Mr. Nolan, you expletive deleted amateur, isn't my favorite villain. He's the best villain. Ra's al Ghul, that's how I'm going to say it, knows who Batman is. He's an immortal, sometimes warlord, sometimes eco-warrior, sometimes aspiring global tyrant, sometimes billionaire playboy, yachting with Black Canary. He's got a hot daughter whom he really wanted to get together with Batman to a degree that was a little creepy. He wants to save humanity for himself. He's as smart as Batman and saunters in and out of the Batcave whenever he feels like it. He's on a first-name basis with Alfred. Just imagine those conversations. There's a ton of reasons why Ra's al Ghul is so awesome, but the reason he's really my favorite is that he is a stone-cold fox. Oh boy. He has two modes of fashion sense, crisp western business suit and shirtless. He first grabbed my attention by having a super homoerotic shirtless sword fight in the middle of the desert with Batman. In the comic, was drawn in the 70s, both men have gloriously fuzzy chests. Seasoned older men are so sexy. I like to imagine just resting my face against their coarse hair and smelling him. I bet he smells like old parchment and time itself, and something spicy. Even in the cartoon, they take pains to animate two uber-macho, glistening, shirtless men going at each other with swords. It's the least subtle, sexy fight since the one between Spock and Kirk in Amok in Time, which is also really hot. Salt and pepper hair totally does it for me. There's something about distinguished gentlemen that gets your fur crackling, you know? The promise of experience and knowledge you don't have and knowing how to really treat a lady. It makes my spine shiver. In my head, he sounds like David Warner mixed with Sean Connery. Even when he's an albino, see Chris Yost and Marcus Toes, Red Robin, he was still panty-dropping hot. But I have to say, I prefer the Arab-looking Roz. His skin is like ashes of roses. It's gorgeous. I just want to lick it. If I were ever allowed to write myself into a comic, I'd have sex with Ra's al Ghul on something really fancy. Rug surrounded by old maps, and a giant globe that's probably opens into a scotch bar. Or have him bend me over some old heavy desk in his secret Gibraltar stronghold. If you made it this far, Aaron, be grateful I didn't decide to write about Captain Boomerang. That is from Allison Berry, Be a Gentle Nerd on Twitter, not Aaron Myers.
This week on the couch, we welcome illustrator and letterer extraordinaire Clayton Coles. I guarantee that everyone listening has read a comic that Clayton has worked on. In fact, you probably have several in your stack this week alone, including two of the three that we just talked about. And if you've ever had a moment when you realize how wonderfully subtle the storytelling can be influenced through the lettering, then you'll understand how excited I am to talk about this today. Clayton is currently lettering Pretty Deadly, Zero, and Three for Image Comics, and Fantastic Four, Young Avengers, Uncanny Avengers, and the upcoming Black Widow and Loki solo books for Marvel, among others. Thanks for hanging out with us today.
Dr. Shuck. Shall we begin?
We shall.
Oh man, it's going to be one of these interviews.
It is. It's going to be a blast.
All right.
Let's hope so.
Well, let's talk shop for a second. So you're coming off a crazy week of deadlines. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, how does something like that happen with your schedule? And what did we leave off the list that Andrea mentioned that you're working on?
Oh, I can't.
There's a lot.
I don't know. There's a lot. I've already forgotten all the Marvel stuff that was listed. There was Fearless Defenders, which we finished the last issue of a couple of weeks ago. Uh-huh. And like Secret Avengers and a bevy of other Avengers titles, I think. Ultimates, a couple of others. I don't know. There's so much now. I can't keep track of it all. Wolverine and the X-Men, that's one.
So how do you manage that kind, like how do you juggle that many books?
I don't leave the house very much. Uh-huh. I generally stay here and my family and friends hate me because I'm always working.
It's a common theme, no matter who we talk to. It's always like, oh, I work too much. I can't balance life and work. And it's kind of a bummer.
I don't mind it too much. It's everyone else who does. I love work. I'm a workaholic. And yeah, live by the sword, die by the sword, etc.
So was last week unusual?
Last week was very unusual. I've never had a week like that before. I had to send 13 books out to the printer within a span of about 5 days. Hmm. And a number of factors influenced this. Two of my coworkers who I work with at Virtual Calligraphy, which is Chris Heliopoulos' lettering studio, we do the vast majority of Marvel's titles. Two of the guys were out the week before that, and so I was covering stuff for them, and some of that spilled over into the following week, and I offered to cover a book that was much larger than I intended it to be or expected it to be. And just doing the number of books I do throughout the rest of the year, sometimes they double ship and sometimes it just avalanches on you, I guess. Mm. And so, like, I guess that's the price you have to pay for working steady for the rest of the year. Once a year or so, you'll have a really bad week where you'll have to do all the stuff you said yes to at once. And then you think long and hard about choices you've made.
Do you don't really get a break, though. It's not like coming after a week like that. You can just take it easy this week.
I sort of can this week, actually. My next 2 weeks for Marvel are very light, so I can just work on the three Image titles and a side art project that I've been putting off for far too long. And yeah, there was a light at the end of the tunnel this time. And
oh, awesome.
It's great to be here. Back in the sun.
Except you're in Rochester. There's not a lot of sun.
Yes, perpetual overcast. How do you know that?
I have friends who live up there.
Oh, do I know them?
I don't think so. They're probably... Well, actually, one of them. We can talk about this later. So can we talk process for a little bit? Big picture first, and then more specific. Like, what does a typical work day, if you can pick a typical type of day, what does that look like for you?
Okay. I usually wake up between 5 and 6 a.m., and I usually go right to the computer and just dive right in. And I usually start the day by either doing corrections that I received the night before or starting a book for the first time that I set up to be lettered the previous day. So
you're always at the computer. You're always
more or less.
Okay. So I am also making an assumption, though, that the workflow is different if you're working on a Marvel title versus some of the creator-owned books that you're involved with. Is that, like, am I making shit up, or is that...
No, I do the image stuff differently from the Marvel stuff, mostly by choice, just so I can do something different that's less in-house style.
Okay, so how is it different?
Well, on most of the Marvel titles, we only use, like, 2 different balloon shapes to do everything. But for the image titles, I use at least 6, just so there's a greater variety of stuff to look at on the page. And on Marvel titles, we use a pre-made set of balloon tails that was made by, I think, Eliopoulos way, way back in the day. But on the image titles, I do all of my balloon tails on the spot by hand. Every single tail there is new.
What do you use to make them?
The pen tool and Adobe Illustrator.
Oh, Illustrator. Points,
pretty much, yeah. Illustrator is the weapon of choice for most of us.
So you've got, besides breaking up the pace between Marvel and indie, like, what are some of the things you do during your work to kind of break it up? Like, I don't know, I work on computers all day, so it's different when you're doing a podcast versus fixing some servers. But mm-hmm. I've got a lot of distractions, like, you know, Twitter or Facebook or Instagram, whatever, you know, that kind of keeps me sane instead of just staring at, you know, server logs and command lines, that sort of thing. So, like, what do you do if you're in front of the computer all day? Is it always Illustrator, or do you have other stuff kind of going on to kind of break the day up?
Oh, there's usually at least 8 different applications running at the time. Like, I am also checking Twitter, since I have an active presence there. I think that's how you guys got to know me. That's how I got to know Andrea, certainly.
Yeah.
And I usually have a TV show or a movie playing in a tiny little box in the corner of the screen, mm-hmm. or I have music playing, or I'm on Skype talking to a fellow creator, or occasionally I'll just stop and go see what's new on CBR or whatever, what's happening in comics world, and like, oh, that article looks interesting, I'll skim through that and then dive back into the page.
But still always within your room, not getting up and walking around and seeing the outside world.
I do get up and walk around, but I just pace around the apartment like a lunatic. And, that's often been a problem when I've been visiting other people and working. So I'll just hop up and start pacing around, but I don't know that I'm doing it. So when I visited Declan Shelby and Jordy Belair, his last name is not Belair yet. And they just looked at me and their jaws hit the floor like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm walking around. You look crazy. You look crazy. And so on. We love each other very much.
Do you have restrictions on what you can watch while you're working? Does it have to be something that you're familiar with, or can you just sort of tune it out?
Usually I put on something that I've seen before, or if it's new, it's something that doesn't have a lot of visual spectacle. So I'm watching The Following right now on Netflix, which is pretty good, tacky fun. And you don't have to look at it very much to know what's going on, but once in a while I can look away from the lettering page and see something cool there. Like a hacked up body or Kevin Bacon. Can't go wrong.
So I let you pick the music this week. Well, yes. Done. I am putting a lot of trust in you for that, because I don't know what you've picked yet. Did you play an instrument growing up or sing or anything? Music seems like it's a pretty big deal to you.
It is. I'm a huge music geek, but I wasn't that terribly instrumental. I played the drums for about 2 years, but the deal that I fell into with my mother was that I could only get a full drum set if I paid for it myself. And since I had a $5 allowance growing up and your basic bare bones drum set cost about $450 or so, or it did at the time, I fell out of that pretty quick. But I do love music very much.
Excellent. Well, let's go back to childhood for a second. Let's go back to your childhood. Let's close your eyes. What's the first comic you remember reading when you were a kid?
Tintin in Tibet.
Ah.
I hear you.
Was that influential? Did you, so that's the first one you read, but was that the first one that kind of clicked comics for you?
I don't think so. Comics were always a part of my life, whether I realized it or not, but I didn't really think about doing comics as a career until I was 13 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's,
I think,
still pretty early.
Yeah, that's what I'm told. Whenever I say that, I'm like, oh man, I should have had this figured out way before. And that's sort of how I felt when I was 13. I was like, wait a minute, I love drawing superheroes. Why do I want to be a psychotherapist instead of a comic book artist? Bit of a leap.
I don't know, they kind of go hand in hand sometimes.
Yeah, you are analyzing people, though they're fictional.
So you're saying that comics were always kind of part of your life. How? Where did your parents have comics? Like, how were you exposed to them? Did you have older siblings that had them?
No, I am the oldest in my family, actually.
Okay.
But, both of my parents are artists, and my dad was into comics growing up. He was a collector during the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there was a Tintin cartoon on when I was a kid, so they eventually bought one of the books, because, like, dad liked Tintin anyway, and I think Hergé is the only comic book artist who I've never heard my mom say a bad thing about, besides Mike Mignola. So, like, oh, Tintin moms. Being around the house was all right.
So it sounds like the family's pretty deep into the comics world, then.
Sort of. Not my mother so much, but definitely my dad.
Okay.
He's fairly proud of where I am right now. And so is mom, but in a different way.
So did you ever, I don't know, rebel against that? Like, did you ever take a break from comics and decide you were just going to read Freud and Jung and dive headfirst into therapy or whatever else you wanted to do?
Even then, not really, because I was more reading newspaper strips at the time. Like, I was like Calvin and Hobbes, and I had a huge Far Side phase right before I decided to do the comics career thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, yeah, it was just always there. It just took me a while to find it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, so you work on basically every comic book that comes out, but what do you read? Do you, since you're putting the letters on everything, do you read comics? Like,
sure.
Yeah. Like, what are you into right now?
Well, oddly enough, I'm still reading a lot of Marvel titles. Like, I'm reading the stuff that everyone else reads and thinks is amazing, like Daredevil and Hawkeye. Yeah. And I'm also reading Thor, God of Thunder, and most of the core X-Men titles, which I wasn't doing before, but I really like them right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading Batman over at DC and a lot of Image stuff, Velvet, Saga, Lazarus, and so on, a couple of manga titles. Whatever I find and end up liking, really. I'm reading about 24 different graphic novels right now, mm-hmm. which is insane, but... I don't know. It's my life, I guess. I dig comics, even when I'm not working on them somehow. That hasn't been beaten out of me yet.
Well, it's interesting because for some people, it's like they're so immersed in it that the reading of them seems to get tainted, I guess. Or,
yeah.
Or the magic of it kind of goes away. And for others, it seems like it only enhances. And maybe
I'd say it's both for me. Sorry, I just interrupted.
No, that's fine. No, that's what I'm curious of, especially when it comes to Marvel. If you're kind of connected to so many of the Marvel titles in their creation, it's the kind of thing that I wonder of, like, how then does the actual story, you know, the universe still stay a Marvel universe for someone?
Yeah, it's tricky. Most of the time when I read comics now, like the first thing that I do is analyze the lettering in every single book. I just can't turn it off.
Uh-huh.
So, and like when I know who's lettering the book, I know which tricks to look for. Like, oh, like, yeah, this is a Joe Caramagna book, all right. That's exactly how I would have done that sound effect in Balloon Tail, and so on. And I'm also so familiar with styles of editing that I can tell who edited a book just by reading it now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, there's a weird joke in the background. This is a Stephen Wacker book. So, like, when I'm not doing stuff like that, when I'm not analyzing the lettering or just the total scale of the artwork or the writing and stuff and seeing how I would split up a balloon or whatever, that's how I know I'm reading a really, really, really good book.
Mm.
So Uncanny X-Force was one of those books for me when, like, the Rick Remender run, because I didn't notice the lettering at all. I was just so into the story. And it's like that with a lot of manga, too.
Do you read print or digital?
Print. The only digital I read is The Private Eye.
Oh, okay.
So is there a bit of a collector in you? Like you said, your dad was a collector as well? Or are you like me and super sloppy casual with all of your comics?
Well, I bag and board them. Yes. But what is it, a guy thing?
I don't know. I don't think so. I certainly know women who are collectors also, but I am not one of them. And I'm almost exclusively digital at this point. So I just think it's a personal preference. And Aaron is super anal. So
I used to not bag and board my comics, and they were all falling apart because I was reading them a lot. So I just started bagging and boarding them out of necessity.
But it's not so much from a collection standpoint. It's not like you have a run missing one and you'll feel compelled to get the one you're missing, whether you care about reading it or not.
Not really. I used to be more of a collector, but now I tend to drop and pick up things really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Clayton, how old are you?
26.
Okay, that's fine.
What does that mean?
Well, I think...
I like that response, actually. That's fine. Okay.
It has nothing to do with anything, but I do think it's
a lot. We can discuss this.
I think it's a younger guy thing. I think that...
Wait, the collecting part is a younger guy thing?
The way that he described it, yes. Not the way that you do it, Aaron. You're obsessive. I'm making that distinction.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I think... I don't know. It's fine. It really is. God. Everybody
it's
is equally
get worse,
loved.
Isn't it?
Yeah, this is...
I can't wait till I'm 40 and buying every book with Wolverine in it.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. You'll be going back. You'll have to get every possible appearance, like his claw appeared in one issue, you know?
Or those, like, weird custom tie-ins. Wolverine's in a book about mattresses.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You have to have those.
Or you could get obsessed about ROM. Who would do that?
ROM Space Knight. Yeah. I have never read a single ROM Space Knight book, but when I see people mention him, they just go ballistic.
Yeah, Aaron is that guy.
But...
Oh, you want to talk about ROM?
Sure, let's talk about ROM.
Tell me about ROM.
Well, I'll tell you why people go ballistic about ROM. It's because it's like a hot girl that you can't have. Because there's because of like the licensing problems with ROM.
This sounds way too close to home for me.
Oh, no.
Then you'll appreciate it because it's like, okay... People want more ROM comics. Why do they want more ROM comics? I mean, ROM's a really cool character, but because you can't have more ROM comics because it's weird, it has this weird licensing problem, people wax nostalgic about it.
Mm.
You know? And I fully admit that. I embrace that. Like, I love ROM because there's not new ROM stuff. You know, we're kind of stuck in the Mantalo run. And every once in a while, like, you know, Hickman throws in Space Knights into Infinity or something like that. And you go like...
And it's never ROM.
But
it's somebody else.
Yeah, but it's hinted at, you know, or something like that. So it's like, that's enough to keep you going.
Mm.
It's a sickness. It really is.
And it's fine.
My family was the same way with The Adventures of Pete and Pete growing up. And there's a huge bitterness that the third season was never released on DVD. Like it was announced for like 2006, and now 8 years later, my dad is still grumbling about it.
Right, and if it never comes out, he'll get to grumble about it for the rest of his life.
It'll keep him going.
Yeah, So it's like I embrace ROM as my Marvel alter ego, I guess. In that, I love you know the idea and his backstory and everything else, and we'll never probably get more ROM comics.
Mm.
You know, and it's the kind of thing that. Because the way it's kind of set in stone in the past, you don't ever have to worry at this point of like somebody doing a good or a bad job of, you know, resurrecting the character.
Okay. Yeah, we don't get a lot of that these days.
No, right.
They can't just die and stay good forever.
Right.
They have to come back and either be made still more good or more often than not just sullied a bit. We're all slaves to nostalgia here in comics world.
For sure.
Very sad.
Right. So it's like... At this point, could you ever recapture the ideal that's in people's minds about a character? And probably not. It's very rare that somebody can kind of come in and beat, you know, our memories, what the past has created of our memories. Because they're not even true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you talk about it, like I talk about it in such a way. It's like, there's no way the actual, you know, run of ROM comics is as good as it is in my brain. And I'm fully willing to admit that. It doesn't
make any... But the mythology of your love of ROM is like an epic in and of itself.
It's true. It's bards sing tales of it. You know, it's a love that is outside of time and space.
Uh-huh.
I find that admirable. to love something so unconditionally.
It's true.
I wish I could still do that.
Maybe look outside of comics for that one.
Yeah.
Nah, it's there. You'll find your ROM. One of these guys. He's out there.
I will find my ROM. Well, there's a ROM in Deep Space Nine, which is my favorite of all the Star Treks.
Yeah.
So I guess that's something. I suspect he's a bit different from the Space Knight ROM.
Yes, but you know, you could embrace that. You could find the actor, you know, who played him, stalk him.
I did once. Well, I didn't stalk him, but I did get his autograph one time.
Well, that's a start.
He was really nice.
You need a lock of hair?
Yeah. Aaron. He still had his hair.
Uh-huh.
Aaron.
That Ferengi helmet.
Uh-huh. I'm trying to help Clayton out here. There's different levels of fan.
God, help.
All right. Should we get back on track, or we just want to just talk another?
I don't know. This is pretty entertaining.
I could go another 40.
That's a lot of inner child you just got.
Yeah. It's true.
Will that disrupt the format of the rest of the show?
No, it's fine.
A little bit.
I'll talk for another 40 minutes about ROM.
Okay, we're moving on. Clayton, if you could go on a road trip to anywhere, where would it be?
Anywhere.
Mm-hmm. But it's got to be a road trip.
Okay, so it has to be on, planet Earth.
Well, you have to be able to drive there.
Okay. But in a car? A vehicle with wheels?
Oh, okay, fine.
Well, could it be, Nick Fury's car?
Yeah. Where would it be?
Well, where we're going, we don't need roads with Nick Fury's car.
Oh, well done, sir. Well done.
Cultural reference.
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably my family's vacation house in Vermont. It's my favorite. There's no one else there except for bugs, but, you know.
Is there an internet connection?
No, there's not. That's why I like it there.
Oh, wow.
That's where I go to escape, which I can only do about once a year. And this year I did it for the very first time, and that was quite lovely.
Like, all by yourself you went?
Yeah.
Wow.
No one else. No cat. No nothing. No neighbors on the other side of my walls.
Did you take music with you?
I did.
What? Give me three albums that you took with you.
Well, I just brought my iPod, so it was every album that I own.
No.
Oh, this is a test.
Now you have to stick by the rules. Three albums. If you only could take three. It is.
You snuck up on me.
Uh-huh.
Careful, she's going to take a lock of your hair.
Ooh, oh,
she's just as bad as we are.
Yeah, she tries to pretend she's not, but she is in the end.
Mm. Yes, I'm the same way. Okay. Well, one of my favorite bands is Blur, and so I'd have to go with their self-titled, because it has the most variety. And it's right between, their pop phase and their cool indie pre-Gorillaz phase. And it has Song 2 on it, and Beetlebum, and M.O.R., and lots of other songs that I love.
Okay.
Bluebell Knoll by Cocteau Twins, which is my favorite of theirs. And they're one of my favorites who I talk about a ton, which very few other people seem to get. I think I've been dumped by at least two different women because of my love of Cocteau Twins.
Yikes.
They just get it. Why do you listen to this caterwauling whale music? Because it's good. What do you listen to? I don't know. Anyway, if I name a specific band, they'll know who I'm talking. Comics Therapy, anyway.
I don't think that's an album.
It's not an album at all. It's totally pandering.
Well, it will be when you put out the Best Of collection and I'm not on it.
Well, now you have to be. It's ironical.
That's very, that was very clever of you.
Yes, that I had to make sure I got my in on this thing that I just made up.
Yeah.
And the last one, I don't know. There's a lot of albums that I love. It could be a Frankie Rose album. It could be one of the Battlestar Galactica soundtracks by the great, amazing Bear McCreary, who's doing Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Pete and Pete soundtrack.
Not the season 3 one, though.
No, that one hasn't been released yet.
Yeah, I've heard.
There's a little bit of bitterness.
Yeah. I'd have to pirate that one, I think.
Well,
maybe I should pick a sexy one in case a girl comes by on the desert island.
On the desert island?
Yeah.
Okay.
You never know.
And yeah. Pete is not a sexy choice?
I don't think so. It might remind them of childhood, which is very unsexy.
Right. Good point. So,
but you find the girl that finds Battlestar Galactica soundtrack sexy, and she's a keeper.
You are set for life then.
Yeah. Have you heard that thing lately? It's got drums and sweat. You can't go wrong. World music is quite sexy. Maybe I'll just go with the sure thing, like Mezzanine by Massive Attack.
That's a good one.
Oh, that's a good Frank one. Ocean. Okay. You passed the test. It wasn't actually a test, but you definitely passed.
Everything's a test with Andrea. Don't let her ever tell you that. So you graduated from the Kubert School, and you've done some illustration work in addition to your lettering. So do you write also, or do you have any plans to do both more illustration and writing and maybe some creator work?
I do write. I have at least 5 different stories that I want to put to comics form.
Mm.
And I've been very bad at keeping up on those this year. But I've also been doing better than I was the previous year on that, so... I blame
Is that something like that. Something that you can kind of look forward to in this very brief down period? Or, I mean, do you have to kind of force yourself to switch gears then?
Yeah, and it's much harder than it should be.
No, I get that. I think that when you're in the zone, like with the work, then the fun work is, it intentionally takes a back burner, and then it, you know, can be difficult to get back to the momentum of working on it.
Yeah, and it's pretty daunting to dive into this different type of work that sort of requires more thought than I think lettering does. Since I'm with lettering, I've been doing it so much over the last 4 years or so that I just know what to do without having to think on it. But with writing and drawing, you got to think about craft and character. So, but yeah, I can't do too much of it during this downtime because I do have to catch up on the aforementioned art project. But hey, at least that's drawing. It's not one of my things, but it'll be a lot of fun when it comes out. And stuff.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
I can't say much more about it.
That's awesome. It adds more like mystery and like an air of excitement. So keep that.
Yeah, it's a good thing I use that voice.
Yeah. So I want to ask about the Yambler pages for young adventures. Because I think they're awesome. And like you, I was super bummed that they're not in the trade. Because I think that they are a very clear part of the story. And I guess using that page as an example, can you talk about your process of creating something like that with the rest of the team? Because it was so unique.
Well, you won't think so after I tell you how it got made.
Well, don't ruin the magic. I don't know, make shit up.
Okay. Well, the Yambler page, full disclosure, was not my idea. It was brainstormed by Lauren Sankovich and the then assistant editor, the amazing Jake Thomas, who I love very much. I hope he's listening. And he said, hey, we'd like to do something in the style of a Tumblr page. Can you do this? And I went gulp. And then I pretty much stayed up the entire next night looking up Tumblr skins and seeing which one I thought would be the easiest to rip off. And so I picked the default setting and Young Avengers defied it up a tiny bit. The title Yambler was my idea. And in each issue, all the little tags you see on the right side, like in the upper right-hand corner,
yeah,
those are all me. Like, I write all of those myself.
Nice.
And it's usually whatever inside joke I'm thinking of at the time or a reference to whatever movie I just saw. Issue 10 or 11, I think, had 2 The World's End references in the little tag bar. Nobody got them. I'm really sad about that. Come on, guys. And they were story appropriate, too.
That doesn't ruin the magic for me. I mean, that's a creative process. That's a creative collaboration. And that sounds like a good editor, too, that trusted you with designing, you know, something entertaining. And that's kind of a big part of the book, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was one of the first books where I really felt like a part of the creative team and not just the letterer.
Yeah.
I'm included in all the chain emails and stuff, so I know who is where and at what time. And we've all grown sort of close, like me, Kieran, Jamie, and Matt, and Mike Norton, and whoever else.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. There's a bond there, which doesn't happen very often.
On books, is that true? Like, is it sometimes pretty formulaic?
I wouldn't say formulaic. It's more assembly line. Uh-huh. This book was unusual in that regard, but there have been a couple of others where we've all formed sort of a bond. Fearless Defenders, to an extent. We all met each other and had a big dinner at New York Comic Con that was quite lovely. But most of the time, especially with some of the bigger titles where there's like a lot of artist rotation and stuff, and the book and the artistic vision of the book is defined by the writer and the editor, there isn't quite as much of that. And it's a little bit more assembly line,
mm-hmm.
which... You know, you got to do that sometimes. They can't all just be crazy, amazing artistic collaborations,
right.
Partially because I wouldn't get anything done because you got to do more stuff that way.
Yeah, and you have heavy schedules to keep to and everything else. Like, it seems like, especially for those two titles, you know, Young Avengers and Fearless Defenders, like, they have a harder hill to climb than, say, like an X-Men title or something like that.
Yeah, Fearless Defenders really had something to prove, being both a Defenders title and an all-female cast title.
Yeah.
It did good, I think.
Yeah, people, you know, it's like, it's a pretty decent run for books that don't have a lot of expectations from the outset.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of lose sight of that. And it's sad because it usually, at least from my perspective too, it seems like when they're getting their core following, which from an industry standpoint probably doesn't translate to mass sales, but then you start getting, you know, the people that become dedicated to a book. And then it's, I don't know, we'll be talking about it 20 years from now, like a ROM comic.
Yeah, that will be someone's ROM.
I'm sure it will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, like, the book did bring in a bunch of new fans, I think. Like, people who weren't really reading comics before, or so I've heard.
Yeah, I've
heard that anecdotally, too.
And that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully there's something else that they can jump onto.
Yeah, like that Black Widow book.
Yes.
That's sort of taking its place.
When is that out?
Soon, maybe a month and a half from now.
Okay.
I don't know the exact date. I just started the whole book last night and stuff. It's quite pretty. I think people will like it.
The art that has been released, like teaser art for that, is like, it makes me drool. I'm very excited about that book.
Yeah, I saw that and I went, what? How?
Yeah. Hopefully that can continue. I mean, it just looks like a tremendous amount of work per issue for that level of art. So
yeah. I think it'll do well. Black Widow has a movie that she was in now. Two of them.
More than two. She just
it will be
popping
three.
Up.
Yeah.
It's almost like it was planned that way.
Huh.
Ooh, sneaky Marvel.
Well, Clayton, this was super fun. Do you have anything else you want to share?
I don't know. Should I talk about the songs that I picked?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, absolutely, because I don't know what they are yet.
Okay, this was a really difficult topic to find
you
music.
You told me it was fun.
It was fun, but it was a huge challenge. I went through my whole library, and it seems like all my music is either really friendly or songwriters just want their enemies to go away. They don't want to keep them closer. They just want them to get lost.
Well, how many did you pick?
I picked two.
Okay.
I chose this one called Narcissus in a Red Dress by The Like.
Okay.
And they were a girl pop group who got together, I think, in 2005 or so, and they opened for Muse. And after doing that, they just became a full-on girl pop group instead of a more progressive Muse-sounding light group. And it's really good. It's like the Pipettes or the older 60s girl pop groups that Young Avengers talks about a whole ton,
right.
Like the Ronettes. And it's a good song. And I also selected You Tear the World in Two by Pale Saints, which was an early 90s shoegaze band. This track is about 2 minutes long, I think, but it's hard and it's fast. And yeah, it ties into the theme good. I think you guys like it. You seem to like alt stuff.
We fight about music every week.
Now, if Andrea got to pick the music, it would all be show tunes.
That's not true, but a large majority of show tunes are thematically appropriate. Thank you very much.
Right, so I actually put a little bit of thought into it, and I pick actual music that has something to do with the show.
Fuck you.
Did you pick music in case I didn't find anything?
No, dude, it's all on you.
Oh, phew. Glad I came through.
Me too.
Pray for
me. Which one is the intro and which one is the outro?
I don't know. Each one could work either way, I think.
Okay.
That's up to you guys.
I'll surprise you.
Cool.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted this this rom comic musical adventure.
Man.
Into the clouds.
Into the clouds.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Clayton.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, we've been looking. I mean, I don't know about Andrea, but I've been looking forward to it.
Oh. It's good not to presume to speak for others.
I tried. I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, I wear my heart on my sleeve. I think it was pretty obvious I was excited about this.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Remember to pre-order your comics. It means life or death to so many titles, especially small press and creator-owned works. If you love a creator or a comic, let your local comic shop know to order it for you, or you might not get to read it again. For all things, we like to point that out to everyone.
Yeah. Mm,
that is a good way to end it. That's my general system for ordering books now, too.
Is pre-ordering them?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you probably know quite well that the pre-orders matter in the modern system.
Well, I just like feeling in control. I love
If you have to venture outside of your house, it's somewhere that you have control over?
Yes. I know what to expect there.
That's good.
I can understand that. Well, everyone, for everything for the show, everything you want to know about us, it's all on comicstherapy.com. And we don't make you pre-order anything, but you should subscribe to the show, just as a side note.
Absolutely.
You can't pre-order the show.
No,
you can send us money though. It's kind of a nice incentive as a, you know, for us to keep doing it.
Probably not gonna do that.
Okay. That's all right. Well, okay. We'll see everyone next week.
See everybody next week.
Bye.